Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor of the New York Times and your moderator for this program. And now, let me introduce today's speaker, Grover Norquist, conservative activist and author of the new book, End the IRS Before It Ends Us, How to Restore a Low-Tax, High-Growth, Wealthy America. Arianna Huffington calls Grover Norquist the dark wizard of the right's anti-tax cult. Newt Gingrich says Mr. Norquist is the most innovative, courageous leader of conservative grassroots activism in America. There's two points of view we'll work with tonight. Grover Norquist founded Americans for Tax Reform in 1985 to limit the size and cost of government. ATR organizes the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, which asks all candidates for federal and state office to commit themselves in writing to oppose all tax increases. In the 113th Congress, 219 House members and 41 senators took this pledge. Mr. Norquist holds an MBA and bachelor's degree from Harvard University. He contends that the Internal Revenue Service has abused and bullied the American people and proposes to replace all federal taxes with a single retail sales tax. This will be the subject of his remarks today. Please welcome Grover Norquist.
Thank you. The book starts with a history of taxation in the United States, which is the history of the United States. Before we were a country, 1774, Americans, colonialists, were paying 1 to 2% of their income in taxes, total. The British in London, the guys that were annoying us, were paying 20%. We were paying 1 to 2, they were paying 20. We had strong economic growth. A lot of people came here and wanted to be here. We went until the Civil War without an income tax. Then we briefly, the North and the South, imposed an income tax. South got rid of their income tax at Appomattox. The North had its income tax until 1871. Then it came back in 1994 for about a year until the Supreme Court struck it down because it violated the Uniform Clause, which required that all taxes be uniform, be the same, and it was a graduated income tax. Came back in 1913. How do we get, as a country formed out of rebellion against the idea that we might go to 3%, how do we end up at 30% federal, state, and local taxes? And I go through about 14 different ways in which the government talked us into higher taxes. During the Revolution, there were the Patriots and the Loyalists, or the Sons of Liberty and the Friends of Government. We still have the Friends of Government with us, who always side with the government when it comes to one of these debates. And the Friends of Government have talked us into higher and higher taxes over and over again. One of the ways is, well, we'll have this new tax to reduce an old tax. New Jersey is perhaps the saddest example of this. That New Jersey had no sales tax, no income tax, up until 1965. They had property taxes, and the property taxes were terribly, terribly high. And the politicians, the Friends of Government, said, here's what we'll do. We will have a sales tax, and then that will reduce the property tax. So they put in a sales tax. And 10 years later, they had high sales taxes and high property taxes. So they said, here's what we're going to do to fix this. We're going to have an income tax, 1977. And they put in an income tax. And now they have a high income tax, high sales tax, and high property taxes. If you have an annoying tapeworm, swallowing two more tapeworms does not get the first tapeworm to be disciplined. Tapeworms and taxes tend to grow. The Spanish-American War tax is, in my view, the perfect tax. It was put in for an emergency, Spanish-American War. It was going to be temporary. The Spanish Empire was not exactly a power in the world. This was not going to be a long war. It was a war, so it was patriotic. Pay your taxes. It was a hidden tax. It was at the bottom of your phone bill. It was a tax on rich people, because only rich people had phones in 1898, because phones cost in today's dollars about $5,000. And it was on long-distance phone calls. Okay? So it was this temporary tax on only rich people. There was just for the war, and it was hidden so no one would notice it. And, of course, it lasted 100 years, more than 100 years. It is the longest-living veteran of the Spanish-American War. We went to work to try and repeal it fairly recently when I went to public school, but I was watching on the History Channel and discovered that this war had been over for some time. And we finally got rid of the tax. But it really was a thing of beauty. It was all of these things together. Because, of course, when people say we're going to tax the rich, when friends of government say we're going to tax the rich, they haven't finished the sentence. We're going to tax the rich first, then the rest of you. And, of course, the tax on just the rich, pretty soon everyone had a phone and everybody was paying that tax. Temporary tax is the Johnstown flood. The temporary tax on liquor to pay to fix the Johnstown flood is still there and gets raised from time to time. And now one of the reasons people are focused on the IRS is because of the recent examples of political corruption, not just corruption, but the political corruption, where the IRS went in and decided to audit people or deny them access to 501c4 status, and the memos were out there, and we know that they were targeting people for political reasons. I served on the Commission on Restructuring the IRS in 1998, and we found then that the Clinton people were doing this, not as much as the recent government, but they were going through all the conservative groups and they were getting audited, and our friends on the left were not getting audited. When I asked the IRS guy to explain this, he said, no, we've got a very fair system, and and I said, great, explain it to us, how you pick people to get audited. And he said, oh, it's a secret. You'll have to trust us. The IRS this time around, it's a little worse than usual. When the Tea Party hit and 1,000 people went into the streets in the week of April 15th, 2009, at least 1,000 rallies, a million people out in 1,000 rallies, this scared the administration. And you saw Lois Lerner, who was in charge of either allowing or not allowing people to have 501c4 status to be able to organize politically, announced on my birthday, 19th of October, 2010, just before the election, that they're yelling at me, they're telling me to do something before the election. Now, the head of the IRS saying that she's being told and pressured to do something about them, about the Tea Party, using the power of the IRS. I mean, if you were in Latin America and the generals were saying, well, they're really asking us to do something before the election, you'd worry about what this is. And a wonderful study done by the American Enterprise Institute, two Harvard professors, a guy from Stockholm and a gentleman from the American Enterprise Institute, looked at where they had Tea Party rallies and where there was a Tea Party rally scheduled but canceled because of rain or weather. So you could compare not places that were excited about taxes with places that weren't excited, but places that were both planning to have rallies, one did, one didn't. And they estimated that between 3.2 and 5.8 million votes the Republicans gained because of the Tea Party activity, that people come, they find other people agree with them, they get excited, they like meeting with people, they get in touch with each other, they start to organize together, and this drove the number of volunteers, it drove contributions, it drove actual votes, and the Republicans took the House of Representatives and picked up a lot of Senate races. And at that point, the IRS closed down the ability of Tea Party groups to get 501c4 status. The door was closed. Left of center groups kept getting it, but they were shut down until after 2012. And you saw the Republican vote in 2012 versus 4 years earlier. Romney versus McCain was up 1 million. Not the gains that you saw on the off-year elections as a result of the Tea Party. The Tea Party was kneecapped. The Tea Party was not allowed to grow organically because they were not allowed. They were denied the legal structures to do so. I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that either the reason or a reason Obama got reelected was because the IRS played an active role in that election, and that had not happened before. And is one of the reasons this last week, April 15th, 7 reforms, making illegal everything that Lois Lerner did, got passed on a bipartisan basis, almost all voice votes, Republicans and Democrats together agreeing, this isn't going to happen again. So This is one of the reasons we're having this discussion about not just taxation, but the IRS, because of its political participation in the last election. I run the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, where we ask all candidates to take the pledge to the American people, not as Harry Reid sometimes thinks, to me personally. The pledge says to the American people, you can see it at the website, atr.org, that I will oppose and vote against all efforts to raise taxes, no net tax increase. Tax reform, fine. Moving taxes around, fine. Net tax increase, no. And today we have a majority of the House members, 49 senators who've all made that commitment, 14 governors. Last election cycle, all of the presidential candidates, save one, Huntsman, made that commitment in writing. And the modern Republican Party has basically made one promise to the American people. We will not raise your taxes. We may invade small countries we can't pronounce, but we will not raise your taxes. And that has been very helpful to them politically. One of the strengths of the pledge probably came from the fact that George Herbert Walker Bush, in 1988, when he was running to get Reagan's third term, defeated Dole in the primary because Dole would not sign the pledge. And just before New Hampshire, in the debate, Pete DuPont handed Dole the pledge and said, all the rest of us have signed the pledge, will you? And Dole reacted as if he was a vampire and somebody just tossed a cross in his lap, which was all caught on TV. He lost New Hampshire. He didn't end up winning. Bush won the primary, and he was 14 points behind Dukakis when he said, read my lips, no new taxes, and he went on to win. 2 years later, he was talked into raising taxes on the promise that he was going to get spending cuts, $2 worth of spending cuts for every dollar of tax increase. He did not learn from Reagan. When they cheated Reagan in 1982, you remember, they promised Reagan $3 of imaginary spending cuts for every $1 of real tax increases. Tax increases are real. The spending cuts never happened. They then went to George Herbert Walker Bush and told him, well, you're a cheaper date. You get two. And that seems to me, if you're going to cheat somebody, you might as well make him feel good. We're going to give you 10. Not really, but, you know, 10 imaginary dollars in spending cuts. They didn't. And Bush threw away a perfectly good presidency. He'd been a very successful president, managed the collapse of the Soviet Union without a lot of blood on the floor, got Iraq out of Kuwait and didn't get stuck occupying the place for 15 years. And yet he raised taxes and it cost him the presidency. No one's life is a complete waste. Some people serve as bad examples. And Republicans looked at that and said, let me get this straight. Take the pledge, win the primary. Take the pledge, win the general. Keep the pledge, get reelected. And that's been the Republican Party's decision. Of course, the pledge isn't just about taxes. Because if you say that you're not raising taxes, there's a second part to that sentence. I will now reform government to cost less. Because raising taxes is what you do instead of reforming government. You say, well, I don't want to reform the government. Here's what I'll do. We'll just keep doing all the things we used to do, the good ones and the stupid ones, and we'll just raise taxes to cover the costs, and we'll keep going. And that's how ships get more and more barnacles, and governments get more and more taxes, and more departments, and more different programs all supposed to be doing the same thing, because they don't end up reforming them to cost less. But the pledge was the Republican Party saying, we're not going to raise taxes. Then you had the Tea Party show up and say, there's a second part to governing well. Don't raise taxes. Stop spending so much money. And that completed the arch there. And that's what turned the Republican Party in 2010 into a completely different animal. If you look at the spending during the Bush years, when you had during 4.5 of the Bush years, you had a Republican House, Senate, and presidency, all three together. Not just about half of the Bush years, he had united government. And they spent too much. Reining in spending was not on their list of things to do, which was unfortunate. But today, the Republican Party had said, look, we're not going to raise taxes. And that's why in 2011, when Obama wanted $2.5 trillion in debt ceiling increase because he'd run up spending, Boehner and Mitch McConnell said, here's what you get. You can have $2.5 trillion in higher debt ceiling, but we need $2.5 trillion in reduced spending over the next decade so that you bend the cost curve of government down by $2.5 trillion. And they won that fight because they weren't going to raise taxes. And we got the sequester, which is an actual spending limit on domestic discretionary spending, military and social spending. And that cap took spending from 24% of the economy down to 20% of the economy in just a few years and has changed the trajectory of American spending as a result. How do we get spending and taxes down towards the 1% to 2% and away from the 30%? I think step one on spending is the Paul Ryan budget plan, and that's the one where they block grant much of the means-tested welfare programs and reform the entitlement spending. That bill has passed the House four times. People said if the Republicans voted for it, they'd all get beat in the next election. Everybody survived. It's passed four times, and there have been several elections since. The modern Republican Party is, with the Ryan spending reform, where the Republican Party of 78, 79, and 80 was with Kemp Roth. It's a party position. If you elect a Republican president to go with the House and Senate, they'll pass the Ryan budget plan, and instead of spending going from 20% of GDP over the next 30, 40 years to 40, it'll go from about 20 to 20. It is a dramatic reform. Without Ryan, we become France, and everybody forgets to bathe on a regular basis. With Ryan, we actually keep spending down towards 20%, dramatic reduction in the size and scope of government, and otherwise we turn into a European social democracy just on the basis of tax and spending. How do we get there? On the tax front, I think the most important thing to start with is to move towards a single rate tax, a flat tax on the income tax. Why? Because flat taxes are difficult to raise and easier to reduce. I'm originally from Massachusetts. Prior to emigrating to the United States, I lived there. And we have in Massachusetts a constitutional amendment, single rate tax. It's 5.25, okay? Liberal, Democrat, Ted Kennedy, George McGovern, Massachusetts, 5.25. Why do they have such a low tax? Because when the politicians want to raise taxes on people in Massachusetts, they say, I've got a really good idea, and you're all paying for it. Well, then we're all listening, and it better be a good idea. The reason why flat taxes are so important compared to graduated or progressive taxes is the progressive graduated income taxes. And again, Massachusetts has had on the ballot five times. How would you like to go to one of those neat progressive graduated income taxes? And five times the voters of Massachusetts have voted that down. And they've had a very public conversation. Look, year one you may raise taxes on the Kennedy kids, but then you're going to come for me. And I think we're better if the Kennedy kids and me are both paying the same tax rate because you're less likely to raise my taxes. And the politicians who prefer, as remember, Clinton said I'm only going to tax the top 2%. Obama said I'm only going to tax the top 1%. You know, the rest of you may want to step out of the room because this isn't going to be pleasant, but it's not you that we're working over. This is the Richard Speck theory of tax increases, that if you can't take on everyone in the room at once, you take them out of the room one at a time. Ask the older people in the room who Richard Speck was. So going to a single rate tax is particularly important in terms of reforming government. The other thing is we now actually have two political parties that are trying to go in different directions. When I was younger, Richard Nixon wanted the government to get bigger, and Ted Kennedy wanted the government to get much bigger. And so every year they had this knockdown, drag out, fight, and it would get somewhat bigger. And we did this year after year after year, the government would get somewhat bigger every year. Not just bigger and not much bigger, but in between bigger and much bigger was the compromise. We now have two political parties. One wants the government to get bigger, higher taxes and more spending, and the other wants the government to get smaller, lower taxes and less spending. What would a compromise be when people talk about the mega issues? Why don't they have a bipartisan compromise? Well, of course, in the old days, everything was bipartisan because the two parties didn't matter. Okay? The little old lady in Mississippi who agreed with Ronald Reagan and voted for George McGovern was reacting to the fact that Sherman had been unpleasant to Atlanta recently. The two parties didn't tell you anything about what they wanted in terms of the size and scope of government. We now do actually have two parties trying to go in different directions, and that's why you have the clash on mega questions, a lot of issues that we can work together on, but not on the big ones. The other piece to this is economic growth. I mean, if you want to reduce taxes, one of the most important things you can do is have, if you want to reduce tax rates, is to have more economic growth. If we grew at 4%, Reagan's growth numbers after the tax cuts, rather than 2%, the growth rate during Obama's presidency, over 10 years of that difference, growing at 4 rather than 2% a year for 10 years, over $5.5 trillion in higher revenue to the government from growth alone. So pro-growth policies allow you to get more revenue and can allow you to cut the tax rates and still have similar amounts of money. So when people say, I need more revenue, one way to get it is to have pro-growth policies. Take the trial lawyers, put them in plastic bags and float them down the river, reduce marginal tax rates. There are a number of things you can do for pro-growth policies, but they do bring in tremendous amounts of revenue over time. You can take a look at selling stuff off rather than raising taxes. Pentagon's sitting on a whole bunch of spectrum. The people in Silicon Valley would love to be able to buy, rent, lease that spectrum, but the Pentagon sits on it because someday they may want it. I think we need to make it clear, look, sell it off and then keep what you need or reorganize to what you need, but there's a lot of empty spectrum that's not used. There's a tremendous amount of oil and natural gas under federal land, under the water, that, matter of fact, trillions of dollars worth that we could sell off, lease off, rather than raise taxes for those sorts of things. We could go back to the base closings bill. These are various spending reduction ideas. Remember, base closing was when we couldn't get bases closed because as soon as you start talking about 10 bases to close, the 10 congressmen and the 20 senators from those bases would go and offer to sell their votes to the sugar lobby. Would you defend our stupid bases? We'll defend your stupid sugar subsidies. And just by suggesting cutting spending, you ended up worse off. You strengthened the friends of government who all banded together in defense of completely indefensible policies. Instead, what they did was the Pentagon came up with a bunch of bases they didn't want, and you got a bunch of congressmen and wise men and women who said, we'll look at them, and then they pick 10 or so, and then unless Congress voted no, those would be shut down. We've done 6 or 7 base closing bills now. We ought to do one every 2 years. It ought to be a regular occurrence. We ought to audit the Fed. We should do that too. But we ought to audit the Pentagon. All the rest of the federal government is audited, but not the Pentagon. My brother used to do budgets for the Pentagon, so I asked him, is there a good reason why they don't audit the Pentagon? He says, well, the Pentagon says there's a good reason, which is that they couldn't pass the audit. That is a good reason to audit the Pentagon. That is not a good reason not to audit, okay? You don't necessarily pass the first audit. I get this, okay? But we ought to have some idea of, well, we can't keep track of all of our planes. They keep moving. You know, I mean, you know, somehow Hertz figures out how many rental cars they have, okay? I mean, this is possible to do. But there are a number of reforms along those lines, and if you audit something, you will find things. We used to have something, an anti-appropriations committee, the Byrd Committee. It was put in at the beginning of World War II to decide what programs has the government been doing that we don't need to do anymore because we need all this money for World War II. And they shut down a whole bunch of programs, and they'd look at them and they'd say, well, we don't really need this. And so this committee did only recommendations, taking it to the floor, to stop spending money on stuff. I think it'd be a good idea to reinstate that. Senator Roberts of Kansas has got the legislation, and I'm looking to work with him on getting that out there. Because if you've got one committee that hopes to get famous and on TV, not by spending money, but by unspending, we could actually make some progress. I would like to ban, I recommend banning, allowing any sitting member of Congress from naming anything they build with federal funds after themselves. It's just one more disincentive to name everything Byrd in West Virginia. It won't stop all of the unnecessary spending, but it will have some effect. I would suggest that it's been very powerful when we ended earmarks, that it is not understood. It's not that much money. It's like $40 billion, you know, just a small amount out of the whole budget. But earmarks were the currency of corruption in Washington, D.C. Here, I'll give you an earmark so you can take $5 million to your district and give it to friends, and you agree to vote for something that otherwise you wouldn't vote for. Okay? You only bought votes from people who didn't want to do what you were doing, things they thought were wrong, and that's what it was used for. And I think it's tremendously positive. And when people wonder about what the Tea Party has accomplished, I would say the key first step they took was the win to end earmarks and that level of corruption. So as we move forward, we can move towards a flat tax, a fair tax. I'm not wedded to a fair tax. It was one of the options I mentioned at the end of the book. I think there are lots of different proposals. There are lots of ideas that we can take step by step. This isn't going to be fixed in a year or 2 years or 10 years. It took a long time to build up the size and scope of government we have. We now need to figure out how to reduce it. But step one, don't raise taxes, which forces politicians to think about reforming government. Step two, move towards a single rate tax so the government has to look everybody in the eye when they raise or cut taxes. And then let's take a look at all the various ways we can reduce spending, where we can sell off things. 10% of the federal budget used to be selling off federal land as we moved west, and then they stopped doing that. So you don't have to just raise taxes. So with that, let me close there, and we'll take your questions and sit down and talk about how we can end the IRS before it ends us. Thank you.
And before we begin the Q&A, I will remind the listeners you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest today is conservative activist Grover Norquist, who is discussing his vision of an alternative tax system that would eliminate the IRS. I'm Quentin Hardy of the New York Times. I wanted to begin by asking you, do you consider yourself a powerful and influential person over the past 20, 30 years?
The tax issue is the most powerful issue in the history of the country. It's almost, well, it did tear the country apart, if you consider us part of England, once. It threatened to tear us apart with the Whiskey Rebellion, with an east-west division. For the first 25 years of American history, everybody thought the country was going to fall apart east-west, west of the Alleghenies versus east. The tax on whiskey was a tax on the currency that mm-hmm. the Westerners used, not a tax on Easterners. And that led to an armed rebellion. Then north-south, a long time before the Civil War, South Carolina in the 1830s called out the militia over the tariff, because that was seen as punitive to the South rather than and enriching the North. So it has historically been in American history, and I would argue, I guess, in most countries, it's the one of the most powerful issues possible. What the pledge does, and what I organized, was a pledge which is allows a politician to credibly tell voters, I will not raise your taxes. I mean, people have been lying about that for centuries, okay? But if you put it in writing and you hand it to somebody or put it up on the web, you can't take it back. The old way of lying was, now is not the time to raise taxes. Taxes are the last thing I do. I really don't want to raise taxes. None of those three people promised not to raise your taxes. They just told you how pained they would be if they raised your taxes. And so the pledge, by being the same wording in all 57 states, really, I think, makes it difficult for politicians to walk away from it or change it. And voters know that, and they trust that a guy meant it. So I do think the pledge is a powerful tool that focuses on a very powerful issue.
Yes.
I just sort of hang out.
You just kind of hang out.
Yeah.
And through the vagaries of history or perhaps intention, you came to embody it in many ways. And in your book and in your talk tonight and in most of your public statements, you tend to fall into a very single vision kind of category. You know, the historian Isaiah Berlin talked about the distinction of the fox and the hedgehog. The fox knows many things and the hedgehog knows one thing deeply. I'd put you in the hedgehog camp, where taxes are the skeleton key to much of history, its woes and its happiness, how taxes are derived.
Yes and no. I think that's a central divide. But once you've laid down your marker on taxes, once you've set up the guardrail, taxes are not going up, you still have to decide what to do. There's a lot of the road to drive on.
Right.
And that's the list of things in the second half of the book are, how do you spend more competently? I'm active with the Right on Crime movement, which is conservatives rethinking mass incarceration, mandatory minimums, how long you have to have, how many people in prison. That's more Fox territory.
In other areas, you're much more complex.
Step one, don't raise taxes. Step two, okay, how do you reform government? That's Fox territory.
Right. But even in the book, as I opened up at the top, you know, in the colonial period when there was 3% taxes, we were all living fine. I was thinking, well, we were living fine, except we had this huge body of slaves who weren't doing so well, and women couldn't hold property, and that wasn't so great. And there were
That was not a function of the tax code.
No, but if you were saying everybody lived great then, there were considerations around that as well. Or when you talked about Bush.
Okay, that is not my point, that everybody was fine, and most people died at much too young an age, and appendicitis was a real problem, and slavery is a bad thing, and weren't very nice to women.
Yeah. We can agree on all. We've already found common ground.
Okay.
But, you know.
However, looking at the tax code, 3%, 2% is an improvement over 30.
To circle back, you know, when George Bush was defeated in 92, you lay it to he broke his pledge. Mm-hmm. That's certainly a dimension. He said it was that the recession didn't end early enough, and that was the real problem. You know, he and Barbara both said that in interviews later.
Yes,
Clinton
they have.
Wrote off.
And why did we get a recession? Well, gee, it seemed to come about the time he raised taxes.
Okay. So is it fair, in your view, to just see the problem as taxes every time or in the majority of cases where government is concerned?
No, it's a major, major part of government, a major part of whether things work or not. There are lots of other factors, but it's a major one, yeah.
Okay. And how would you judge the state of politics in America today? People say, you know, it's polarized or there's gridlock or there's a lot of poison in the atmosphere. But we were speaking before and you think it's actually in quite a good place in some ways because the lines are clearer.
Yeah. Well, as we discussed, you know, when you could vote for Republican or Democrat and you had no control over whether you just voted for bigger government or smaller government, there weren't two competing ideas in American politics up until recently. There was the government should get bigger and the government should get bigger faster, two wings of politics. Those guys were not, in my view, in real having a serious debate, and they weren't offering one to the American people. We now do. You want a bigger government? You can go one direction. You want a smaller government? You got the other. You got two parties that will pretty much give you that. Every Democrat will vote for a tax increase, and every Republican will vote against a tax increase, and you have two parties that mean something, and it matters. And those are important issues, and they should be honestly argued out in campaigns, not lie to the people and then, surprise, you elected me, I'll not tell you what I'm going to do.
Right.
You know, that's not a good idea.
And you spend time in Washington watching the function of it. Do you feel it actually is gridlocked, poisonous, and all those tropes that people put against it?
Well, they're not going to agree. The president's unlikely to sign a significant tax cut. But the president did just sign or agree to sign the reform in Medicare. The Democrats signed on to Medicare from the doc fix. Okay, this reduces the cost of government over the next 75 years. The present value of the spending cut that they passed is $3 trillion, which is a good chunk of our total debt. $3 trillion in present value from that reduction. And that was done bipartisanly without a tax increase. And so I think there are times and places where we had a unanimous vote a couple years ago to reduce the disparity between how we treated crack cocaine and white powder cocaine, which was 100-to-1 disparity. It brought it down to 18 to 1. I don't know where 18 quite came from, but 1 to 1 made sense to me. We got for 18 lower than 100. It was a unanimous vote. Had to be a unanimous vote to get unanimous consent in the House. That's a lot of bipartisanship mm-hmm. on a very difficult issue. These things can happen. You're seeing it on criminal justice reform. Rand Paul and Cory Booker are working together to rethink the criminal justice system in a more humane and less expensive way.
So do you think...
Yeah, there's progress.
Does the media treat it too much like a sports event where one side has to be ahead and one side has to lose?
Yes, and I understand why they have to, but we just have to take a longer view.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take some questions from the audience now. We'll go straight to 2016. Which candidate can beat Hillary?
The one who wins the primary.
I congratulate you on your firm grasp of the obvious.
Well, this is, when they asked Alexander who gets to be in charge next, and he says the strongest one.
No, but what will be the dominant values, you think, that will swing the election for, swing the election for the
There's going to be general support for dramatically reforming, replacing Obamacare. They're going to be generally in agreement on dramatic tax reform. We've seen Rubio's tax reform, which is very pro-growth and I think quite good. Rand Paul's, I've seen an outline of it. It's going to be very strong. I think all of the candidates will endorse the Ryan budget reforms. So what you really should be voting on, what I'll be voting on, is the narrative of the guy's life and example and how strong and tough they've been, because I think they're all largely going to be in the same place in terms of their stated policy positions. But how tough are you? And that's where you have Chris Christie saying, hey, I had an overwhelmingly D legislature and I cut $130 billion out of the unfunded liabilities in the New Jersey pension plan, something California needs to work on. You've got Scott Walker, who tackled the AFL-CIO three times in order to give more flexibility to local governments on how to manage things. Perry, 14 years, the best governor in the country and keeping growth down. And if you didn't have Texas, we wouldn't have had a recovery. There's this, and Jeb Bush, serious tax cutter as governor, reformer, school choice. And then some very interesting senators like Rand Paul doing some very innovative thinking. So I think there's a lot of the depth of the modern Republican bench is very impressive. Compare it to 4 and 8 years ago. 4 and 8 years ago, 2 or 3 people were running for president, and 8 people were running to sell books or be radio talk show hosts or do marriage counseling. Okay, they were not running for president. Mm-hmm. 3 guys were, and the rest were having fun. And this time around, you're going to have 8 people out there, any one of whom could look you in the eye and say...
Many of whom clearly want the job.
Yeah, and are competent and have been governors and done amazing things.
And what is your view of Hillary?
I think that the Democrats have put all their eggs in one basket, and they'd better take care of the basket because they don't have Plan B.
Mm-hmm.
I keep recommending that the California governor run because I think there's a lot more opening than other people see.
How do you think he's done?
As governor?
Yes.
I think you still have a rather high marginal tax rate compared to the rest of the world. I still think that California has a pension problem that's bad and getting worse, and there will be no federal bailout. Okay, 8 years ago, people thought there might, but the other states have been sweating bullets to fix it while the California government been screwing around and not fixing it. And so that unfunded liability gets worse and worse and worse. And Utah, they passed a law. All new hires starting about 2-3 years ago have a 401k. All new hires. Cops, firemen, 12% into your 401k. Everybody else, 10%. And there are no more unfunded liabilities. No more unfunded liabilities being created in Utah. Louisiana's taken steps in that direction. So is Kansas. Our friends in Rhode Island just dramatically reformed their pension system. Very left of center governor. She won the governorship. She was the treasurer. She dramatically reformed pensions. The unions tried to do her in the primary. They tried to do her in the general. She won the primary. She won the general as a left-wing Democrat. You can be a left-of-center Democrat, watch San Jose, and reform pensions. I thought that's what Jerry Brown was going to do as governor, and he didn't. So California is carrying this dead weight, expanding dead weight cost of the unfunded pension liabilities. And since the other states are all working on it, if California is going to be Detroit on this pension system, they're going to be Detroit by themselves. There's not going to be some federal bailout. If anyone's telling you that's coming, that ain't happening.
Okay. Take another question. If we eliminate the graduated income tax and replace it with a flat value-added tax, that means people would pay the same rate irrespective of their disposable income. Is this fair? Would not a more equitable system be a flat tax on income plus capital gains as well as a sales tax?
Okay. Fairness and taxation are interesting concepts because taxation involves taking money from people who earned it and giving it to other people. So fairness is not a real big part of that process. But I do like flatter taxes because they're tougher to raise, not because they're fair, but because they're tougher to raise and simpler to watch. I worry very much about a VAT. The goal of the modern left is to add a VAT, value-added tax, to the income tax, and then you're Europe. Then we're not the United States, then we're not different, we're Europe. Then the difference between the size of government in the United States and the size of government in Europe is the value-added tax in each country, whether it's Sweden or Britain or whatever. Value-added taxes are very easy to raise. They've been doing a lot of it. They grow. And the danger of discussing swapping out an income tax for a value-added tax or a retail sales tax is that for some moment or moments, you have both. And you could end up with both permanently. And I think that's extremely dangerous.
Okay. Someone else in the audience asks, what flat rate do you propose is sufficient for our needs, which includes paying for public schools attended to by you and so many others? What taxes would you rearrange to better allocate current collections?
I don't know that you can set a particular rate at this point. Samuel Gompers, is the labor leader, when asked what working men and women wanted, he said was more. Okay. What do I want in the size and cost of government? Less. And we should just move towards reforming government to where it costs less and then see how it goes. We may hit some point people say, this is just right. Let's not have it any smaller. And otherwise, let's keep moving to expand liberty, give people more opportunities, and try and make government cost less. Our government's a taxi commission, and it's an Uber world out there. We have a lot of reforming to do.
Mm-hmm. There's also a question about what happens when there's an emergency. And in your book, you say, well, at that point, we should just accept across-the-board cuts. If it's an emergency, we state it in those terms. Everybody feels the hit. We accommodate that way.
Yeah, that's what we did in the 90s under Clinton because there was a fear that when there were these emergencies, you know, like a flood or a drought in South Dakota, they'd announce as an emergency, and then all 50 states would get spending things stuck into that emergency. The way to stop that was to say the only money South Dakota gets to fix its problem is going to be from cutting spending across the board. And then people said, well, you can't be adding other things to it. So by having an across-the-board cut to outweigh the new emergency spending, you discipline the threat of overspending.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try and link two questions here because one is deeper history, but I see it related to another one. Besides voting for candidates who support tax revisions, what civil disobedience is best or advisable for a citizen besides not paying taxes? And then someone else reaches back and says, what do you think about people who during the Vietnam War refused to pay that portion of their taxes towards the war?
Yeah, I would not advocate non-payment of taxes as the way to go. It has been done during the Great Depression. There was a property tax strike in Chicago area. It's not impossible. I'm not sure we're in that much trouble at this point. I still think we can defeat people in elections. We can change mayors and governors. And I think if you have time and energy, that's the place to put it into.
We're in a place of enormous wealth here. And there's a lot of talk about the social dislocation of San Francisco's new wealth coming in. So with that in mind, someone asks about the disproportionate accumulation of wealth And your thoughts on capital gains taxes, which allow a Warren Buffett a lower overall tax rate than his secretary.
Capital gains tax is a tax. You pay, you earn $100, you pay taxes. You invest $100, you pay taxes on the interest, you pay taxes on capital gains, you pay taxes on the corporate income tax if you invest it in the stock market. A capital gains tax or a death tax may be different rates than the original income tax, but they're taxes on the same dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I would really argue that we're much better off if the government would say, you're going to earn a dollar, we're going to take some, and then we're going to leave you alone. Because the government is not going to say, if you drink it, we don't care, but if you invest it in Microsoft, we're going to come back and penalize you for that. I would much rather the government say, when you earn a dollar, we take a certain percentage. We can have an argument about whether that's 2% or 30%, but a certain percentage. Then go away.
Mm-hmm.
Don't follow me around and ask what I do with my money and to try and get more pieces of it, and punish you if you invest it, and don't punish you if you spend it. Why that incentive structure?
Mm-hmm.
For civil liberties issues, we should structure the tax codes to reduce the intrusiveness in our lives that taxes can be.
Okay. I think this is a Prop 13 question. Why do I pay 5 times the property tax of my next-door neighbor?
Because Prop 13 was not written as well as the Florida version. The Florida version says your property taxes can only go up, I think it's 3% a year, total, the total bill. We don't care what the assessment is. We don't care what the rate is. The bill can only go up 3% a year. And originally they said until you sell your house, just like you guys did in Prop 13. Then the assessment, everything can jump way up high. Well, all of a sudden people realize that selling a house, the house was worth a lot less when you sold it because the next guy was going to get hit with a boat anchor of a tax increase on it. And so they went to, okay, when you sell the house, the new guy will also only see 3% increase from what you paid last year. I think it causes problems when you say if you sell property, the property tax goes up. Because among other things, businesses tend not to sell. People do. And so the business property ends up taxed lower than individuals. And then people say, that's not fair. And as soon as somebody says, that's not fair, duck. Because the politicians, when they get done making it fair, will make everybody's taxes higher.
Mm-hmm. Someone raises a good question here. What makes you confident that this, a flat tax or a simplified tax,
yeah,
wouldn't ultimately be abused by loopholes and exemptions the way the federal income tax has been or the way the corporate taxes have been?
Once you get to a single rate tax and you try and reduce rates and simplify the tax code, it's just harder to poke the first hole in a tax system than the 27th.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it'd be easier to maintain, as Massachusetts shows, as Illinois shows, they have a flat rate income tax, as Pennsylvania shows, they have a flat rate income tax. It's tough to go from a flat rate to a graduated rate.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a longtime resident of the Beltway, you got a lot of friends, Republican and Democrat, who kind of make a living pushing for loopholes. They ever tell you, like, hey, Grover, dial it down a little bit, you know, we sort of like manipulating the tax code here? Not in so many words.
Well, you do get pushbacks from the ethanol lobby, which had a particular tax break that we fought against. We won. There's a very good bill that would eliminate all of the targeted tax credits in the energy industry, oil, gas, solar, wind, everything, eliminate them all and take the corporate rate down 1% or 2%. So it doesn't raise taxes, but it gets rid of all the targeted tax credits that are specific to energy. Pompeo, Congressman Pompeo of Kansas, has the bill. I think that's a great bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Federal spending has increased at a rate of 1.4% per year under Obama. It increased to 10% under George W. Bush, 8.6% under Reagan. Isn't Obama the real fiscal conservative?
Well, Obama created a reduction in spending as a percentage of GDP in the same way that Clinton dramatically increased the stock market and cut the capital gains tax He lost control of the House of Representatives to the other party. All of the spending restraint flowed from when the Republicans took the House, and all of the economic growth under Clinton took place after November of 1994. And so, yes, while you were president, I'm much more interested in who runs Congress. If you want to know what works and what doesn't work, look at Congress. Forget the presidents. Look at Congress, and that's where you'll see the cloud is. You run the country out of the House of Representatives, except when the presidents decide to do particularly dumb things in foreign policy. And that's where the power is over time. Presidents can veto stuff. Congress passes stuff.
Here's a foreign question. How do you feel about the future of Europe, given the Greek crisis and the way it's been handled?
I think Europe will continue to exist as Europe. I think they made a big decision in not taking Turkey and Ukraine in. I think that would have been important structurally, politically, as well as economically. Europe doesn't do immigration very well. You know, they didn't bring in Turkey because they're afraid of immigration. They get mad about Polish plumbers. You know, the guys are all these Polish. What's the matter with Polish plumbers? I don't get why the British or the French whine about that. Kind of these guys, they come and they fix all our pipes. It's terrible. What?
They don't charge as much.
And they don't charge as much. That's the other dirty trick. Look, I never got all weepy about the old country because my grandfather left because he said it sucked. So I'll go back and look at the cathedrals, but I'm not particularly interested in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Someone asks about Kansas, and this is obviously a question you've had to address quite a bit lately. Sam Brownback comes in. He does some, in your eyes, heroic tax cutting, and the deficits are up. The economic growth compares unfavorably to the neighbor states. They're now $600 million in the hole. He did get reelected.
Yep.
But it's not just about getting elected. It's about producing a good outcome.
Sure.
Is that the cleanest experiment in tax cutting we've seen, and do you like the outcome?
No, it's a completely unclean experiment, but it's still a good experiment. Kansas is a state with a bipartisan history of lousy governance. Kansas had Lincoln Republicans. Lincoln Republicans are the counterpart to that little old lady from Mississippi who is still voting about Atlanta. Okay, they're going, well, Lincoln was a Republican, so I guess I am, because they were with the North in the Civil War. And they tax and they spend and they do all this other stuff, and they still count themselves as Republicans. So they were Republican governors. The Republican Party was the tax-increasing party in Kansas up until recently, because they were the party in power, and they raised taxes and they spent like crazy. They then get a Reagan Republican governor, Reagan Republican House, and then the governor primaries 13 sitting Republican senators, beats 11 of them, and gets a Reagan Republican House and Senate. What had happened was he wanted to, Brownback wanted to bring the spending down, taxes down, income taxes down. And he had rates down, and he broadened the base, limiting some deductions and credits. The liberal Republicans who are on the chopping block and going to be primaried took his bill and made it a massive tax cut, took all the offsetting eliminations of deduction of credits out, and passed this massive tax increase, tax cut, and said, the governor will never sign this. The House will never sign it. It's much too big. And the House said, we'll sign it. And the governor, and so they went to pass it. And then so the Democrats were trying to repeal their own bill. The liberal Republicans were trying to repeal their own bill, and they were filibustering against the bill being passed. Anyway, it passed. Governor signed it. Then you had this too large tax cut, or larger than they'd planned, but that was because our friends, the liberal Republicans, had tried to pull a dirty trick. So what they then did was they said, okay, we're going to bring up the sales tax 1 point, but so that it's not a tax increase, we're phasing out the income tax over the next 15 years. So every time revenue comes in more than up 2%, the income tax clicks down permanently, ratchets down towards zero. If there's slow growth, it doesn't ratchet down. But if there's growth and more revenue, it ratchets down to zero. So that's where we are now. You have a court telling them, mandating them to spend money, and that causes some problems. But the larger-than-expected tax cut was our liberal Republican friends' being annoying at first. So that this, hey, we'll take it, and then we fix it afterwards. Kansas is the model for phasing out the income tax by saying revenue that comes in beyond expectation goes to ratcheting down the income tax. Governor of Maine just announced that's their plan. They just passed this through the House of Representatives in Mississippi. They did this in North Carolina, taking it down to 3% on the corporate rate. Arizona is going to do this. Louisiana wants to do this. There are 10 states that will do this in the next 10 years. So watch that idea of as revenue comes in. Not, you don't have to slash other spending big time. You don't have to raise some other tax. Just as revenue comes in, you put a cap on spending, and you phase out the income tax. That's why the left hates Kansas.
There's so many reasons.
It's the future.
It's the future?
Yeah.
But at the same time, Nikki Haley is saying we're not going to follow that model. Ohio is going slow. Indiana is going slow. They look at these deficits. They look at the subpar growth and say, we tried a radical experiment. That didn't really work.
The governor of South Carolina wants to cut the income tax.
Yeah, she's but they're going to go much more slowly than Kansas did. The radical approach did not work in their eyes. Do you agree or not?
No, I think the radical approach got us first of all, we moved 11 annoying Republicans off to go work in the private sector and become organ donors or something.
Be nice.
just one kidney. I'm very happy with the general direction. Sure, it was a mess, but the other team was trying to make it messy on purpose. Watch Ohio. Governor wants a $500 million cut. And the House just said, no, $1 billion. And in Texas, the debate's between $4.6 billion in cuts and $4.9 billion in cuts over the next 2 years. So I like this kind of conflict in the Republican Party between the House and the Senate, between $4.6 and $4.9 billion in tax reduction.
You talk like a man with a wind at your back.
I think we're doing quite well, yeah.
Okay. Well, I got a whole passel of questions here around Norquist the man. I'm going to touch on him a bit. Why don't you run for president?
Because I don't want to.
Free country.
I live in D.C. We don't even get electoral votes.
Okay. I will. One of my own. You went to Burning Man last year.
I did. It was great.
How'd you like Burning Man?
I loved it.
You know it's on public land.
It is on public land. We are going to fix that later.
Okay.
It's very important that the government own this flat, dusty plain so it could be protected.
Where else are you going to test nuclear weapons?
I mean, if it was a parking lot, you wouldn't notice. But it's a thing of beauty. It's just a little dusty and very flat. Burning Man, there are two things, places in life that I've been to that were more impressive than I expected. The Eiffel Tower was cool. I thought it was going to be cool. But Petra in Jordan and Burning Man were just phenomenally different, bigger, cooler, more impressive than I expected either to be.
Say more. What did you see?
Well, Burning Man, they have 75,000 people show up, okay? And everybody brings their own stuff. This is not Woodstock. You have to bring your own stuff. You bring your own water. You bring your own food. You take care of yourself. They set up roads. Otherwise, the rules are up to you. I did get asked, would you come to this group and give a lecture, said somebody. I said, sure, because I thought, great, now I've got a schedule. Now I know it. Now I know what I'm doing one day. It was the Psychedelic Drug Association that I was speaking to.
If I saw Grover Norquist at Burning Man, I'd be pretty sure I was hallucinating.
This is not everybody dresses up oddly. Only 1% of people are not wearing all their clothes. It does go 24/7, so you need earplugs, because whenever you want to go to sleep, that is not a consensus position with everybody else. and there are times when the dust is so bad that you need the goggles.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you just walk down, you see all these fascinating things in people, and you run into stuff. It was fun. It was great.
If you go back, what's your costume going to be?
I brought costumes last time. I brought a Soviet uniform from Afghanistan from the 80s.
Whoa.
Because I thought maybe you're supposed to. I brought one of those Moroccan, gown things that makes you look like Gandalf. Because I said, okay, now I'm covered. And I just wore my normal desert gear. Mm-hmm. And I didn't wear the cool stuff because not everybody was doing that.
Okay. This is a somewhat possibly delicate question, but certainly I'd be interested.
Could you please comment on your recent resignation from the NRA's board of directors?
And No. I didn't resign. I was elected to the board.
Okay.
Somebody attacked me, and I said I wanted a review of the attacks. You can only do that if you step away from active participation in the board. Since the board doesn't meet for 6 months, that really doesn't mean very much. So they can do that because somebody was trying to smear me, and I said, yeah. I want that written. I want in writing the study of those accusations.
This has been a sort of interesting and controversial, uncomfortable episode for you because your sister married a Muslim and you married a Muslim, and now on the internet there are all these theories. I think the line I got was part of fundamentalist Islam's 30-year program, a key player.
To marry off into my family?
Yeah.
My sister's husband is an Arab Christian.
Okay.
The bigots have a hard time keeping track between Muslims and Arabs.
Right. And in your own case, though, you are, you know, Glenn Beck recently comes out and draws a line between you and the Islamic takeover of America. What's it like to be tied up inside conspiracy theories like that?
Well, I get a lot of that. It's part of the territory.
Yeah.
I've been part of the Russian Jewish mafia. This same guy who has me with the Islamic stuff, also gay. Also at the same time.
God, you must get a lot of tax write-offs for all that.
I'll tell you, the membership dues are
kill
add
you,
up.
Really, huh? It's true.
It's, you know, it doesn't matter because all the guys I work with know it's silly. And it's just part of the territory. People get frustrated. They get mad. They wonder why they're not employable by the federal government. And they decide it's your responsibility that you did it to them. The guy who went after me used to go after Scowcroft as a active agent of the Soviet Union while he was busy taking it down.
Mm-hmm.
So it happens.
How much money do you get from the Koch brothers that is given to your chosen candidates? Are you a conduit? This is interesting though because you worked for a Koch Foundation 78 or something, weren't you with David Koch in a think tank? Wasn't he funding a think tank you were in back then?
1978?
78, 79? No?
I don't think
so. The things you read on the internet, see?
Okay. I like the Kochs fine. They tend to micromanage, so they're not significant contributors to what we do.
That is to say you'd prefer not to take their money because they're off doing their own thing and nanomanaging it?
Yeah, and they micromanage.
What are your funding sources primarily?
Well, we have 100,000 donors and... 100,000 donors.
Okay.
I mean, it's everything from direct mail to email to major donors and stuff.
Okay. Back to taxes. I understand that the fair tax is the only proposal that would end the IRS. Is that correct? Would the flat income tax maintain the IRS?
Well, look, you're always going to have some institution. It's like the KGB or the Czechists, and, you know, they change the name, but it's the same shop. And so you could get rid of the IRS and have the, you know, Internal Revenue Commission, which is, I think, what they started as. There will be a structure that collects taxes. I think the structure of the tax helps determine how intrusive the group in charge of this is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's... you can just get rid of the income tax. You don't have to replace it with something. The first part of that question was, what about, is the only way to get rid of the income tax to have a fair tax, sales tax? No, we didn't used to have an income tax. If we get the government down to a reasonable level, I'm not sure we necessarily have to have an income tax.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see when we get there.
Okay.
I can wait. We're on track.
We're at 2 minutes, and unfortunately we've reached the point where I have time for one last question. I want to throw you something sort of broad. What do you feel you can and should accomplish in the rest of your working life? And what do you think are the greatest promises and the greatest threats to this country?
I think something along the lines of the Paul Ryan budget plan, which reforms entitlements so that they don't collapse the country. Moving pensions from defined benefit to defined contribution so that they're sustainable both in the private sector, federal and state, and local sector so that it's stable and we don't end up displacing all local government with pensions costs. I think if you do the pension thing and reform it, and you go to full school choice for all parents, so whatever the federal, state, or local government spends on your child follows your child to homeschool, public school, private school, however you want to do it, and you put parents in charge of making the decisions, then I think I could think about retiring and write murder mysteries.
That's your real dream?
Yeah.
Okay.
Historic-based murder mysteries.
Very good. Our thanks to Grover Norquist, conservative activist and author of the new book, End the IRS Before It Ends Us. We'd like to also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet.